We are going to begin today talking about Yosef. Joseph. Now, for Rabbi Soloveitchik, he had, it seems, an affinity for Yosef. I think it went beyond the fact that they had a common name. There was something about Yosef's life that Rabbi Soloveitchik identified with, which may emerge partially from what we'll see today. But in fact, in Rabbi Soloveitchik's first work of philosophy, he opens it up with the quote, when Yosef is sitting there about to sin in Potiphar's house, it says he saw the yukno shel aviv. He saw his father's image peering down at him. And Rabbi Soloveitchik symbolically opens up his work of philosophy with this line, almost to say, like, I recognize I am breaking with the tradition of my family, of brisk, which we spoke about in the past, which was this Torah-only approach of just the base medrash of Torah, and I've entered into the world of the Western thought. Additionally, another place where he broke with his family was when he joined Mizrahi. The Brisk dynasty has always been and still is very opposed to Zionism for their own reasons, not necessarily the same reasons as the Hasidic world, but Rabbi Soloveitchik broke with them when he joined Mizrahi. Now, even his own Zionism is not necessarily the Zionism of the Mizrahi that we know nowadays. He would not be comfortable with the phrase Reshis Smichat Gulasenu, the first flowering of our redemption. He had his own conception of what Zionism was and why we're celebrating Islam. We'll get to it at some point this year, hopefully. But as well, in his address, when he starts discussing Zionism, he opens it up discussing Yosef and who Yosef was, and we'll get to that address today as well. Because, again, identifying with the idea of Yosef was someone who was able to stand against the tide. So Rabbi Soloveitchik clearly saw himself within the character of Yosef. What I want to do today is talk about Yosef, and especially try to figure out what was it that Yosef did that aroused the animosity of his brothers. What was it that caused, as we know, clearly it wasn't that one day his brothers woke up and said, Yosef, we need a little cash so we can go to the corner store and buy ourselves some soda. They wanted to get rid of Yosef. They wanted to even kill Yosef, and only at the last moment, it seemed, because of a last-ditch effort of their brother, they sold him into slavery. So Yosef must have done something. What was it that he did? So we'll discuss it. I have multiple approaches. What was it that he did? I want to go and try to develop a little bit of what was it, and we'll see it comes down to not just a few things that he did, but actually at the root of who Yosef was is his character. And from there... Now we're saying we're being negative about the brothers. They decided to sell him off because they wanted a little cash to buy soda in the corner.
No, I mean, from Yosef's standpoint, he must have done something.
I assume most brothers don't wake up one day and say, we're going to kill our brother for no reason. I would hope, especially people such as the Shvatim, who were considered the leaders of the Jewish people and the people who we want to emulate. So then again, my hope is over the next hour or so, or whatever it is, half hour, 45 minutes, to develop and try to figure out a couple ideas of who Yosef was, then really to settle on one of the ideas and see it was something about his character, and from there to learn a lesson for us in general, but particularly when it comes to the world of Hanukkah. So, let's open up with the very first verse, the first source. Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef, and Shiva Asishana. This is the told us the story of Yaakov. He had a son, Yosef, who was 17. Hayiro as Achiv Etzon Hunar. He tended the flocks with his brothers as the helper to his father. He was a nar being a young boy. We're going to come back to that word. As Bnei Bilhah, as Bnei Zilpah, not only the children of his of Rachel and Leah, but also the sister wives, the whatever that funny relationship was with Bilhah and Zilpah there. Neshi'aviv v'av Yosef as dibatim ra el avihem. And the Pasuk right tells us that Yosef used to bring bad reports about them to their father.
Tattletale.
Exactly, tattletale. Now, working with the assumption, which we're going to work with today, that Yosef and the Shvatim were great people, and even at a young age, there's more to the story than simply just tattling. So if you look in the Mepharshim there, it seems that there was almost a disagreement about how to interpret certain things. But let's go on a little more. V'Yisrael ohev es Yosef, mikol banav. Always a recipe for healthy family dynamics. Yaakov, it's interesting, by the way, calls him Yisrael here. as in the name in last week's parsha, well, in this week's parsha, actually, when Yaakov gets into a fight with the angel, and at the end, when he ultimately perseveres, the angel says, let me go, and he goes, bless me, he changes his name, says, you'll no longer be called Yaakov, from now on you'll be called Yisrael. Which, interestingly, by the way, we've heard that said before with Avram. You'll no longer be called Avram, now you'll be called Avram, and what happens? From then on, we're always called Avram, so much so, it seems to me there may be even a prohibition to call him Avram after his name is now Avraham. Whereas Yisrael, we reiterate that, you're no longer Yaakov, now you're going to be Yisrael, and lo and behold, we call him Yaakov just a couple sukkim later. So we're not going to get into what's going on there, but I would say, just food for thought, there may be something about Yaakov being, we call him Yaakov when we're discussing him within his family, and we revert to Yisrael when we talk more about the destiny, and him more as a figure for destiny. Klal Yisrael, the children of Israel, not Klal Yaakov. Either way, Yisrael always Yosef Mikol Bano. And Yaakov loves Yisrael more than all of his other children. He ben zekunim hu, because he was a child of his old age. V'asalik l'son as possible, so he makes him this coat of many colors. So not only does he love him so much, because again, he's the ben zekunim, he's the youngest after many years. He's also the youngest, he's the only son at this point, the only child from Rachel, who we know was the wife that Yaakov actually wanted to marry. But then he goes ahead and he creates this garment, this cloak that you can of many colors, so that not only do the brothers know, oh, by the way, our father clearly favors him, but now whenever he's walking around, it's clearly apparent. And we know it must have really bothered them to the extent that what's the first thing they did after they got upset at him? They ripped this garment off him. Fine. By Yerachik he osa of Avihem, and the brothers saw that he loved them more, we call Achav, v'yisnu oso. So they in turn hate him. They could not speak friendly to him. As in, this animosity and this contentment begins to brew to the fact that they get so upset about this favoritism that they're no longer even able to speak friendly with him. Think about the sibling rivalry when the kid comes down in the morning and they can't even say hello. They'll just pass the sugar or whatever they have at the morning breakfast table. And this is what's happening. So the question again is, what exactly is happening? At face value, if I ask you, what is going on here? Why do the brothers hate Yosef? What would you tell me?
Because his father loved him more. Not because of the bad reports, but because he loved him more.
Well, it seems to be.
It says bad reports. It doesn't say whom. The wives, the brothers, or both. And again,
very, for sure.
Because his father loved him more, not because of bad reports.
Elliot.
He was obnoxious too.
He was obnoxious in what sense?
Yosef?
Yeah.
All
right, so I think both make sense. Elliot's saying if you just read the verses, it seems to say they hate him because he loved him more. But I don't think Ellen's off either. You know, that can also play. He said he was a tattletale. Maybe his father loved him more because he was constantly at his father because he was constantly going and telling what was going on. So this is, I think, again, simply if you look at the verses, if you look in the Mefarshim, they start to flesh it out even a little more. Can I bother someone to get me a cup of water?
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay. Rashi says, he picks up in the word, says, "Vahu na'ar." He was a young lad. She'osim masin na'aros. He did things that children do. Matakim asaro. He constantly was playing with his hair. Mashav einav. He was playing with his eyes. Yeshu na'ar yofa. He was obsessed with his appearance. He was standing in front of the mirror all the time. You know, like, you know when that your kids at some point, they hit like that age when suddenly they just become obsessed with their appearance and they want to look cool and everything? You know, 11, 12, whenever it may be. So this is, yeah, Yosef, he was a child. He was a child. Is this the reason they hated him? I don't know, but it could be. Again, he's a lot younger, and you can imagine it. You have a lot of older siblings. They're the ones who are in business. And you have a younger kid who just wants to kind of tag along. When the kid's first born, Baruch Atah Adonai Melech HaShem Kol Nevro. When the kid's first born, it's cute. But at a certain point, it becomes a little annoying. It's like, come on, you're doing childish things. We're doing real things. We're out in the world. Go play with your toys. Come back to us in a couple of years. That's what Rashi says. Is it a reason for hate? I don't know, but the reason is an annoyance. Annoyance. And maybe that annoyance becomes hate once he realizes the father still favors him. The Sephorno says a little more than that. He says not just that he was obsessed with his appearance, but he was very naive. Listen to what he says. It's actually very perceptive. Utei naruso, because of his immaturity. Chot delavi das achiv ki lo nasev lo esponin la'achros davar. He used to badmouth his brothers. He used to come to them and say, this is what, you know, Reuven is doing, this is what Zebulun is doing, this is what Yisachar is doing, etc. And he didn't think about the long-term consequences of talking about his brothers in front of his father because he was immature. Sometimes you could be correct, but it's not always what you say, it's how you say it. He was immature. So I don't even say, we can even assume it wasn't Lashon Hara, but that's what I'm saying. Sometimes it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And because he was a young boy, and he's coming to his father and saying things that sometimes we know, young kids can say things that are the most insightful and on target, and it stings the most, because they're young, and they're immature, and they don't realize in their naivete about feelings and emotions and about long-term effects. It's funny, I was just telling Emma last night, I have a sibling, I won't mention who it was. She is a very strong young woman. When she was, I think, 8 or 9 years old, my parents were away, and she was home. She wasn't home alone. I think my grandparents were there. We had someone who came to clean our home. My parents were away for a week. She used to come on Mondays and Fridays. Monday, the lady was there, and she went into the fridge and helped herself to some food in the fridge. I assume my mother must have told her, if you're ever hungry, take something. Well, that food happens to have been my sister's. Either way, Friday, there's a knock on the door, and this woman comes back to clean the house. My sister opens the door and says, "Hi, you're no longer working here anymore," and closes the door. Because when you're young and immature, you don't think of the long-term consequences. That happened to be, I think my parents also wanted to fire her, but they never they felt bad firing this poor woman. So, but you have an 8-year-old who was a strong-willed 8-year-old, now she's a strong-willed, I'm not going to give her age, you don't know which one of my sisters it is. But again, we're not thinking of the consequences, so you can do that. So here's Yosef, he's young, he's immature, and he kind of says things because, hey, Dad, look what they're doing. And again, it ends up being that it creates his animosity, it creates his hate, they're not able to speak friendly with him. Others suggest, yeah. I'm not defending it. We're trying to develop Yosef's character. Others suggest, and the Ramban says, that the fact that Yaakov appointed him to be the head of his business, that started creating some animosity. Why are you choosing him? And I think the Abarbanel actually has a very insightful insight. Anyone ever reads the Abarbanel? So the Abarbanel, the joke is, if you read the Abarbanel, you become a heretic. Because what the Abarbanel does is he'll open up with like 8 or 9 questions, which are paragraphs, each one's a paragraph. And then he gives his answer, but by the time you get through all his questions, you don't have time for the answers, so you're just left with a lot of questions. So that's the joke, become a heretic if you learn the Abarbanel now. But in one of his answers, he says, think about this from the perspective of history. You have Avraham. Avraham has 2 children, older child Yishmael, younger child Yitzhak. Older child is his child, he loves his child, but ultimately what happens, Yitzhak usurps Yishmael, he becomes the heir apparent, he ends up becoming inheriting the Abrahamic dynasty, and Yishmael's pushed aside, he goes off to Mount Seir, etc. Next generation, you have Yitzhak. Yitzhak has 2 children, older son is Esav, younger son is Yaakov. What happens? Esav goes to his place. Yaakov is the one who ultimately takes over the business and takes over the family. He becomes the heir apparent. He takes over the Abrahamic dynasty. Now you have the next generation. You have Yaakov has many children. Older sons are there. Comes along the youngest son. It only makes sense that Yaakov's going to do what he saw Abraham do. And so he saw what Zeta did. He saw what the Tata did. He's going to do the same thing. And the brothers now are like, wait 1 minute. We don't want such a thing. And so the reason that the animosity develops, the hatred develops, is because they're like, wait, we're trying to just protect ourselves. We don't want to be rejected from the family. We don't want to be ejected from the family. We don't want to be sent out. Like Esav got sent out to his place, and Yishmael got sent out to his place. And therefore, they ended up starting to loathe and hate Yosef.
Okay, tell them still, then the next part would be the youngest brother.
It could, again, I think it's, we're trying to develop the character here. The killing also could have been in the heat of the moment. But the way that comes to that is oftentimes crimes of passion develop over time. The heat of the moment, that one split-second decision is because of long-simmering discontent and hatred or whatever it may be. So before we even get to that moment, what is building towards it? So I think it's interesting. Simple verse is, Yaakov seemed to favor him, which also chose him to be the business. We had Rashi who said he was immature. We had the Sephorno who said that he was immature, he was naive, and used to say things and it hurt them. And we had the Abarbanel, which I think is a very insightful comment, that from the perspective of history, they thought they were about to be ejected from the family, and they wanted to protect themselves. However, Rabbi Soloveitchik takes a different approach. Rabbi Soloveitchik takes a different approach, and he says, if you want to understand why this discontent, why this breakdown happened in the family, you have to understand who Yosef was. And to understand who Yosef was, you have to go into what made Yosef great, and that was Yosef the Baal HaChalomos, Yosef as a dreamer. We have to go and develop who Yosef was by looking at him as a dreamer. Which is interesting, by the way, because when Yosef goes to find his brothers, the story, Yosef, Yaakov says to Yosef one day, go find your brothers. But this is the, Yosef goes, first of all, Rabbi Soloveitchik points this out, he goes to the first place and he meets a mysterious ish, a mysterious person, doesn't say who it was. And the ish says, oh, you got to go over to Shechem, and that's where your brothers are found. Rabbi Soloveitchik points out, anytime we're in a moment, a critical moment in history, there's always a mysterious ish, mysterious person. Who that person is, it doesn't have to be named, because that's...
Is that an angel?
Well, Rashi says that it was the angel Gavriel. But that's also perhaps God's way, it's God's hand in history. Through the mysterious ish. Either way, so what happens? Yosef starts approaching these brothers in Shechem, and the Bayiras Merachok, the brothers see him from afar, and that's when they say, oh, here's our brother coming, and that's the moment, the heat of the moment, let's kill him. Vayomer Ishalachiv, each one turns to the brother. They say, Hine Bala Halomas Halaz Ba. Here comes that dreamer. Here comes the dreamer. So again, that seems to imply, again, the slur they have from is the dreamer. There's something about the dreams that set them off. That got them upset. Calling him the Bala Halomos. Just a random story. When I was in, I believe, second grade, I was always a decent student, until I wasn't. When I was in second grade, I used to space out a lot. My mother was once called to the principal's office. And the principal was complaining to my mother how I used to space out a lot. So my mother said to him, well, isn't it apropos? His name is Yosef, and Yosef was the Bala Halomos, the dreamer. She didn't realize the principal's name was Yosef as well. He didn't find it funny. I still spaced out. All right. So what's the story with the dreams? Yosef the dreamer. Let's read through the dreams, and then we'll slowly take them apart and understand who Yosef was. So Yosef's brothers already are not very happy with him, as we noted, for all these reasons. And then one day, again, just think of the family dynamic. You have this dinner table going on there. They're all eating, and they're all kind of like sneering at Yosef. I don't know if it's ever happened at your table. That one sibling who everyone else was upset at. And Yosef, oh, by the way, last night when you were all sleeping, I had a dream. You want to hear my dream? And this is going to cause them to hate him more. He said, hear this dream that I have dreamed. Now, when he said I had a dream, they knew, again, listen to this. We were all sitting in the field, binding together sheaves. Suddenly, my sheaf gets up, it remains upright, and all your sheaves gather around me, and they bow down to my sheaf. Implying servitude, subservience. Do you mean to reign over us? In most Tim Shabano? Do you mean to rule over us? And they hated him even more for these dreams. Here's Yosef saying that I'm having these dreams where I am going to be the leader. If you hate me now, and you think I'm a pain in the neck now, I'm a thorn in your side now, well, I have these grand visions where I'm going to be the leader, these visions of grandeur. I'm going to be the leader to the fact that you're all going to be bowing down to me. Doesn't sound like it goes well. Next one. He says, oh, that's not enough. I had enough of a dream. Don't worry, we're still going here. They said, okay, tell us, Yosef. What's this next dream? Not just you guys. Do you think you guys are just bowing down to me? Like the things in the world that everyone is subservient to, as the sun and the moon, or the sun that goes out, the world collapses. Everything revolves around the sun. And all the stars, the constellations, mishtachvim li. Like now it's not just like you guys are subservient to me, but like the entire, I'm the center of the universe. I'm the man. Galileo is wrong here. It's not that we go around the sun. The sun goes around me. You know, you're reading this. You're like, I know people in my life who think they're Yosef. I know more than one person in my life who think they're Yosef, which is kind of a steer. It's a kind of a contradiction. Can't all be Yosef. But hey, physics is funny. Okay, at this point, the brothers had it with him. And that's when they go off, and this sets the tone. So what's going on here? What is going on here? So right, Salvation points out a number of amazing things. He says it wasn't that Yosef was a nar, who was just saying, had these dreams of grandeur, because he thought he'd be a leader. First of all, he says, if you look at the dream carefully, he says, suddenly my sheath gets up. That implies that the leadership was thrust upon him. It wasn't something he volunteered for. He's saying again, these aren't dreams that he's conjuring his head because he's, you know, these are from, you know, during the day he was thinking these things, and at night that's what he's thinking of. But this is in a way a nevuah, a prophecy. God is saying to him, you're going to be a leader whether you like to or not. But what's going on here? Why did it arise? Why did it cause animosity? So, Reverse points out as follows. You can look at the quote there. It is remarkable he should have dreamt about binding sheaves. This was something which was ordinary, which ordinarily they had no connection. Why? What were the Jewish people at this point? They were shepherds. To become an agricultural people laid for them still as their destiny in a distant future. One day they'd have a land. One day they'd all have their own plots of land where they can grow and they can plant and they can sow the soil and they can... But until now, they were a nomadic group traveling from place to place in the land of Israel. Even before that, Avram had to go from one place all the way to another place. Yitzhak, they're all traveling all the time. Right? The whole story of the forefathers, they're traveling from place to place. If agriculture was so much in his mind that he dreamt of it, the brothers were justified in thinking that that could only be due to the teaching and information given to him by his father Israel over the expected national destiny of the house. And more than that, could the brothers believe themselves justified in saying, well, indeed the future be king over us, perhaps even rule over us. Such a thought could never occur even in a dream. They were taken aback, by two things. One is they said it must be that the father told them this, which created jealousy. But also, I think, they realized that Yosef was coming from somewhere totally different. For them, until now, they're brothers. They all kind of came from the same stock. They all thought the same thing. Life is good. Comes on Yosef, and he's like, no, things can be different. I have a different vision of what humanity can look like. Not a nomadic group of tribes going from place to place, but settling down, tilling the soil, as Rabbi Israel said, planting vineyards, having a house, having a couch, being in place, exactly. That he had a totally different conception of what things would be. He was going against the tide. He was saying, I'm not afraid to go against the tide and have a different vision for where humanity is going. And that already is scary. It's scary when someone gets up there and says, let's do things differently. Let's do things differently. It was radical as well. And what caused Yosef to do this, though? What caused Yosef to go against the tide, to buck the trend, to say, I don't mind doing this, more than that, I have a different vision? So Rabbi Soloveitchik argues as follows, that Yosef had two fears. Fear number one was he feared that once Yaakov passes away, the destiny, the covenantal community entrusted to Avraham, or given to Avraham by God, who then gave it to Yitzchak, who then gave it to Yaakov, would disintegrate. And we probably all know this in our lives, especially those of you among us who are a little older. Think of, many of you probably have cousins and cousins beyond your cousins, and had cousins growing up who you're no longer close with, who your children probably don't know are your cousins. I'll tell you, in my own life, my great-grandmother, my grandfather told me, she held the family together. She came to America, she was very young, and so long as she was alive, all of her relatives who came to America as well, she came right after the First World War, they were all very close. She was the matriarch of the family. My grandfather is the youngest of all the cousins. His oldest cousin was many, many years older than him, will be over 100 now. He was the youngest. He said he grew up, all his cousins were constantly coming through his home. All his uncles constantly going through his home. But once his mother passed away, the family kind of fell apart. And you know, as much as it's sad, it's also a reality of life, and it's part of like, but then he created his own family, and he has his own children, who have their own cousins. That's kind of the way life works. So yes, I know I have a cousin who's in California, who's a third cousin, who's, you know, I think in a minor league baseball. Cool! For me, I have no relation to it. For my grandfather, it's a little sad, but at the same time, I have cousins I'm very close to, who are my first cousins and second cousins. That's just a fact of life. But for Yosef, he was petrified. That what would that mean if Yaakov's family fell apart, the covenantal community, this idea of this notion of monotheism and everything that Avram introduced to the world, Yitzhak then perfected and Yaakov then brought into reality would disintegrate, would dissipate, would disappear. And Yosef said to himself, how can I hold it together? How can I ensure that now that we are 12 siblings, we will go, even once Yaakov is no longer with us, everything that he stood for would still be with us? He said there's only one way that can happen. If there's a strong ruler, a strong leader, who will allow these ideals to be perpetuated. So that was his first thing.
You grew up in a religious family. One grows up in a religious family. His cousins are born. I don't know if a person necessarily says, well, I'm worried that all these cousins are religious now, and I've been doing religious down the road.
Well,
what basis?
Well, we have a religious framework and we live our lives. Yosef, this is all it was. All of Judaism, using an anachronism, but all of this, we'll call it Judaism, was these 12 siblings. And what happens when one goes this way, one goes that way, one goes this way, it's over. What's going to hold them together? What held them together so far was Yaakov and Yitzchak and Avraham.
Well, his values.
But what happened to Lot when he left? What happened, I'll tell you this much, what happened to all Avram, when he traveled, took all the people that he made in Haran, with all the converts. We never hear of them again. Right? By the way, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, one of my mentors, he loves to say, it's a very good point, he talks to rabbis, especially young rabbis, he says, ultimately, you can have many people you make in Haran, but who do you take with you? Your family. So when it comes to the congregation versus family, who takes priority? Your family. So you should all know that. Sorry. He says, yeah, he goes, I know, at the end of the day, who's going to be standing around the hole in the ground looking down at me? My family. Everyone else, they're gone. They're your priority. So, that's the idea here. That was number one. Number two. Number two, he's also concerned knowing that that Avraham was promised, and this was a negative promise, that he would have a child, and that child would have another child, and they'd have they'd create an entire people. But part of that promise was also we'd end up in a foreign land of Egypt, where we'd be put into servitude. Put into a foreign land that had different values, different mores, different ideals, different ways of thinking. And Yosef also realized that even if the family stays together, once we go into the land of Egypt, how do we know we're going to emerge? Maybe at some point, what is Martin Luther King's, what did he say? The arc of the universe curves towards justice. So we would be freed. But who's to say we'd be freed and then we'd emerge still holding the Abrahamic covenant intact? Maybe we just assimilate and become like every other person in Mitzrayim, every other person in Egypt. So how is he going to ensure not only that we stay together as a family, but also emerge out of Egypt as a people, as a Jewish people? It's these two things, these two major concerns that led him to have these dreams of saying, I have to be a leader. Or at least they're God saying to him, I'm thrusting this leadership upon you to ensure that when you go into Mitzrayim, you're going to ensure not only are you going to stay a people, but you're also going to stay a people intact with the values of Avraham, the ideals of Yitzchak, and the way of life of Yaakov. If you look in the quote from Esau Vitzchak I brought down here, and then we'll see, by the way, how Yosef not only had these thoughts, but he ended up living this life. This is a quote from the book from Five Addresses, which is Esau Vitzchak's five addresses he gave at the Mizrahi Convention. So as I told you before, when Esau Vitzchak joined Mizrahi, the Zionists, a break from his family. So he very much identified with Yosef, who's talking about, as we mentioned a minute ago, having to break with his family, having to introduce new ideas. He says as follows, what did Joseph seek? To what did he aspire? What foreboding troubled him? The answer is, an obscure feeling of insecurity frightened him. What were the elements of this insecurity? The biblical Joseph was not persuaded that Yaakov dwelt in the land of his father's wanderings, would endure for long. The word, your seed shall be strangers in an alien land, kept tolling in his ears. He saw himself and his brothers in an alien environment far from the land of Canaan. In new circumstances and under new conditions of life, In his dream he saw, behold, we are binding sheaves. We are no longer in Canaan. We are in the land of Egypt. We could no longer be shepherds. We are integrated into a new economy with new styles of living, characteristics, and laws. Basically, he dreamt of a new framework within which the unity of the family could be preserved, even in the far-flung places where the creator of the universe would scatter them. His constant preoccupation with the continuation of Abraham's tradition amidst a new economic structure and civilization. The brothers did not understand him, for they looked upon the future as a continuation of the present. They perceived all their problems from within the framework of their life in Canaan. In the traditional surroundings and the thoroughly familiar habitat of the patriarchs, they did not need new framework or novel economic methods. The biblical Joseph relates, and behold, the sun and the moon, the 11 stars bow down to me. There is a secular, great, and powerful technology creating wonders and changing the foundations of our life. Even if it is true that in Canaan we can get along without it. His secular culture entails destructive elements, many negative perverse aspects. Finally, we will have to relate to it. The confrontation will not take place in Canaan, however, where the temple of life flows serenely, but the new alien land. So what he's saying is a number of things. One is, we're going to go down to Egypt, as we just said, and I'm concerned, I'm scared, what's going to be? And the brothers couldn't perceive this. The brothers just saw life for as it was. They weren't dreamers. They didn't have the vision of Yosef. For them, whatever problems are going to happen, we can figure it out. We can figure it out because we've done this. Our father did this. Our grandfather did this. We live in Canaan. They couldn't envision. They couldn't see. They didn't have the clairvoyance and notice that things might be different than what it was now. And for that, they resented Yosef for saying, no, things will change. It's scary when the prophet gets up there and says, things are going to change. More than that, Yosef said to them that, well, now we're living in the serene Canaan, just living among ourselves. So what are the biggest issues we have? It's, again, sibling rivalry. Once you enter into an alien place with alien values and culture, it's a whole different ballgame. You're going to have to learn to live with people who hold different views. You're going to have to learn to contend with different views. You're going to have to learn to know what it means to be able to live in a society that on the one hand has what to offer you, but on the other hand has what that you have to reject. It's a whole different tension. There's a certain ease to live secluded, sequestered, cloistered off from the world. It's easier that way. It doesn't work. But it is easier that way, and theoretically, if you can live in a monastery, not have to deal with whatever challenges of the world, there's an ease to it. But reality will hit you in the face at some point. You can't do so. And Yosef is saying to them, we can't do so. And the brother's like, no, but we want to do so. We hope to do so. They built on each other. We'll get to that in a minute. Yosef said to my feet, we will not be able to maintain the separation between us and the surroundings. Right now, again, we can live among ourselves. We can trade among ourselves. If we will not be prepared for new conditions, the environment will swallow us. On the other hand, we think of future, we can plan. They wanted the status quo. He was saying, the status quo, while it's ideal, perhaps, it's not going to be, we can't maintain it. It's also interesting to notice, we think of a dreamer as someone who lives a rosy existence. You're dreaming. I had a dream. But like, dreams can sometimes bring great pain. I know we talk about this in this forum, but we spoke about it once this year. Someone who's a Navi, a prophet, oftentimes we find people running away from being a prophet. Yonah runs all the way to Nineveh. Yirmiyahu tries to run away. To be a prophet, it's a lot of pain to have vision, to be able to notice things that other people around you don't notice. It can be painful because you have to see things. People can be very happy, and you have to shake them a little bit and say, no. You think you're happy. You think it's going to be good, but like, you're living, you're the child, actually. You're the naive one. And I'm the one who sees things from the thing. And it's therefore we see that it's through Yosef who comes to his brothers and says, wake up, realize it's not always going to be this way, that creates this animosity. But I want to take it a step further, because what ends up happening is that Yosef then lives this credo of being able to not only say things different than his brothers, but actually be someone who stands against the tide, who's able to live there and do things different than everyone else. And I'll tell you what, he pays the price for it. He pays the price dearly for it, not just because he's sold into slavery, which again, if he's sold into slavery is a dear price to pay. But his life just becomes this tragedy, where time after time again, he's willing to stand up for what he believes in against everyone else, and he gets thrown into prison again. And he's an outcast. But he ends up becoming a tragic model of what it means to live in an alien society with a different vision of ideals, of morals, of the conception of what the good is, and to be able to sacrifice and pay the price to be ultimately what it is to be a Jew in the exile. To be different. To be different. When Yaakov... Well, let's pause there. Any questions on that? Okay. When Yaakov was giving the blessings to all the sons, when he gets to Yosef, see, he's giving blessings out. This is in Vayechi at the very last moment of his life. He gets to Yosef, and he says to Yosef as follows, Vayimrohu v'yirbu v'yashmitu balichetzim. Archers bitterly assailed him. They shot at him and harried him. V'yoshev v'iton kishto. Yet his bow stayed taut, and his arms were made firm. It's poetry. They were assailing him, they were shooting at him, yet his bow stayed taut, his arms remained firm. What does that mean? What does that mean? I think this is really the key to Yosef. Yaakov, he's saying to him that despite what people are doing to you and yelling at you and everything happening in your life, you stayed firm. Yosef's strength for his salvific rights manifested itself in the strange ability to survive with a separate spiritual identity under circumstances and conditions that warranted complete assimilation and integration. Rabbi Soloveitchik goes on to say that, quoting Aristotle, that long ago, Aristotle tells us man is a social animal, joined to other human beings by doing what they do, adapting to what they do, and trying to, in a way, erase the distinctiveness between them. That's what we do. We follow the pack. We don't like being different. Right? What does Thoreau say? If man does not keep pace with his companion, let him step to the music which he hears, or drum beat which he hears, never measured or far away. We don't like doing that either. We don't like stepping out of the beat. We try to assimilate. We try to do what everyone else around us does. Whereas what did Yosef do from the moment, again, when he comes to his brothers and says to them, hey, I have a different vision. Don't be a nomadic tribe. Let's settle down. Let's plant, let's till the land. To the fact that he goes to this woman in Potiphar, and he says to her, I'm not going to sin. You want me to sin? I'm not going to sin. Is it because I see the vision of my father? Or because I know what is right, and even if you're pressuring me and pushing me and hounding me and heckling me and pestering me, I'm not going to do it. Yosef was someone who was able to stand against a tie whose bow didn't break. It's tragic, but at the same time, he then becomes this model for what it means to be able to stand against the tide. In fact, when Moshe is not allowed into... It's interesting. Moshe and Yosef have the same request. Both of them want to enter into the promised land. Moshe never makes it to the promised land. Yosef does. When he passes away, they bring his body there. And there are those who say because what happens to Moshe? Moshe, when he runs away, he comes to Midian, as we learned this week. He gets to Midian. And he saves these girls at the well. The girls come home, they save their father to Israel. We were saying the father, who they say, Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian man. There are those who say, what happened? Because Moshe introduced himself as an Ish Mitzri. That's who he identified himself. Egyptian, he grew up in Egypt, he grew up in Paris, Palace, that's how he saw himself. Now he's an Egyptian man in exile. Whereas Yosef never lost his identity. Even when he was living in Mitzrayim, he saw himself as an Ivri, as a son of Yaakov. And for that reason, he was able to enter into the land of Israel. For that reason, even when he was a viceroy in Egypt, he recognized he was different. He was distinct. And you know what? Because of that, he paid for it because they recognized it as well. And they never treated him as one of their own. They always recognized, for pragmatic reasons, they needed his help. They needed his help. They needed his clever ideas for saving the economy and ultimately saving the country. But they always looked at him as distinct. Yosef was able to live, not just preach and talk about and dream about being different, but he lived that way as well. Reb Soloveitchik points out, and it's the book called Days of Deliverance, Essays on Purim and Chanukah. He points out, and this brings us to this week's parsha. He says that Yosef and Yaakov, both of them, they end up becoming a model for what it means to live in the exile, in Golus, in two very different ways. Yosef in his way, and Yaakov in his way. Yosef in his way, and Yaakov in his way. So listen to what he says. Let's read it inside. Jacob, he said, was taken away from his parental home and went through a long night of darkness, misery, and distress. His assignment was to live in exile. Abraham didn't live in exile. He tried to visit Egypt for a short time, but he became entangled over Sarah and was deported. Isaac could never leave Israel. The first to live in exile was Jacob. He was burdened with the mission of living in exile, of proving to the world that the covenantal community is capable of practicing Abrahamic unique moral code, of being close to the Almighty, of employing a lifestyle of saintliness, not only in the promised land, but in exile, far from the hills and valleys of Hebron and Shechem. In Lavan Garti, I have sojourned with Lavan, yet I observed 613 mitzvos. I still managed to keep all the mitzvos. Jacob stayed with Laban for 20 years, enough time to settle down and become a citizen of Haran, and to consider himself a veteran resident of Haran. He could have said in Laban Yashavti, I live there, I settled there. But he said Garti, I sojourned there. He felt a stranger in Haran. And with the way his son Yosef later felt a stranger in Egypt. He had not assimilated, he had not integrated himself into Laban's society and community. He had not accepted their morals, their code of ethic, their lifestyle. He sojourned in Haran for a long time, yet he preserved his moral religious identity, his commitment to the God of Abraham, his commitment to the way of life that the God of Abraham sanctioned, his commitment to the promised land. All these commitments and many more were not affected at all. Yaakov was dedicated at the end of his 20 years of servitude in Laban's house as he was the first night he spent on the cold stones in Bethel when he pledged the Lord shall be my God. At the completion of his sojourn in Haran, the angel of God revealed himself to Jacob, I am the God of Bethel, where you did anoint a pillar, where you did a vow to me. In other words, you remain loyal to your past spiritual heritage and faith to me. This is the story of Yaakov, that being faithful happens even in exile, in the dark exile, in a place where things are not rosy, when there's persecution. When you're being constantly, when everything you're trying to do is being constantly switched up by your evil host. Yosef, however, was burdened with a similar task. He again had to prove that Abraham's covenant would be practiced outside the promised land, that the moral laws were not contingent upon geography and chronology. The difference between Yaakov and Yosef's assignment is a dual one. First, Jacob had to prove that the Torah is reliable in poverty and oppression. That the immigrant, no matter how hard he has to work for a livelihood, no matter how poor and oppressed he is capable, if he makes up his mind, to give devotion and loyalty to his ancestral tradition. It's a powerful idea. Think about the turn of the century when so many Jews showed up to America, poverty-stricken, with nothing, and yet somehow found a way to scrap together a few dollars to either create a yeshiva day school system, which now is, it's a miracle, or to send their kids to school on a Sunday to do the little they could, even though they had nothing. They literally had nothing and not assimilate. That's what Yaakov was. Yaakov was saying that even though you're an immigrant and you have nothing and you're poverty-stricken, the Abrahamic covenant, the Torah is realizable even in this environment. Yosef's mission was to demonstrate that enormous success, unlimited riches, admiration, prominence, and power are not in conflict with a saintly covenantal life. The immigrant, no matter what his destiny turned out to be, glorious success or miserable failure, can, if he possesses the heroic quality of either Jacob or Joseph, attend to his commitment. And secondly, Jacob had to manifest his heroic quality in backward country, Haran, with a pastoral camp. Joseph demonstrated his heroic action in the most advanced civilization of antiquity in Egypt. This is what Rabbi Soloveitchik writes. Just fleshing out this idea of Yosef. Yosef, again, was someone who was able to stand against the tide, who demonstrated that even living in Egypt, having everything, he was still able to maintain who he was, maintain his ideals, and say that the Torah is still relevant, and I can still maintain it, living where I was. And he contrasts it in a fascinating way to Yaakov, who lived in the dark oppression, and also said the Torah applies here as well. And both of them have what to teach us about living in exile. Rabbi Soloveitchik then goes on to say that historically, we have done a lot better in the exile of Yaakov. When we were rejected from the world around us, when the society said no, when they said no Jews allowed, and we had to maintain our own identity because we were forced to, so we did pretty well. It's when the world opened up to us. That's when the assimilation started, and that's when we struggled with the exile of Yosef. That's when we struggled with saying, like Yosef said, I don't care, brothers, what you think. You need a leader right now. And God appointed me, so I'm going to come out there, even if you're going to hate me for it. And I'm going to say, we got to stay together. We got to band together. We got to keep this alive. We got to go to Egypt and keep this going. We got to recognize that even though we have a different vision, even though we have a different approach, that is value, and we're going to find a way to make it go. There's the exile of Yosef that we struggle with, and we have to think about how we can maintain it in this dark, in this, I guess not dark, but this wonderful gullus of Mitzrayim that we're in nowadays. So that's what Roy Soloveitchik says. We do have anti-Semitism, but let's be honest. The anti-Semitism we have now pales in comparison to the anti-Semitism that many of our ancestors faced, as scary as it is. One last idea once we're here, and this is just a quick Hanukkah idea. Rabbi Soloveitchik points out, and this is a separate idea just from Yosef. He said, if you look at Yosef's dreams, he had two dreams. He had dreams where he dreams of material success, of saying that we as a people can materially do well. The she is bowing down, that whatever is going to happen, we're going to be successful. But he also had dreams of the celestial bodies bowing down, a spiritual success. And Rabbi Soloveitchik points out, he says, I'm not an interpreter of dreams, but what Yosef seems to be saying is that we have to be aspirational. On the one hand, we have to dream to be successful. Successful financially, successful physically in where we are in life. And that's not a bad dream. We also have to recognize that at the same time, while we dream of success in our physical lives, spirit in our lives when it comes to business and our careers, that does not come in conflict with also being aspirational in our spiritual lives as well. And sometimes people think it's a give and take. If I'm successful in one area, that comes at the cost of being successful spiritually. You know what? So I'll give more tzedakah, and I'll find ways to compensate for it. But ultimately, I'm not going to maybe be the Talmud Chacham, or I'm not going to be able to spend that amount of time in shul learning or going to minyan, because, look, there's a give and take, and I'm going to spend time in one area, and I'll find a way to compensate, but I can't be aspirational in both. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, no. Yosef was saying, be aspirational, be dream about both. Dream of being aspirational when it comes to your physical situation, your career, but also be aspirational about your spiritual life. And he goes, that's what the Hashmoneim were as well. The Hasmoneans. He says, they dreamt. They said, we're going to be successful, stand up against an army. But the moment they were successful, what did they do? The moment they persevered, they put down their swords, they put down their spears, they put down their swords, and they went to the base of Mikdash to light the menorah, symbolizing the spirituality. That there too, they were aspirational as well. How can we light the menorah and illuminate the world with Torah? The idea that comes out of the menorah, of the Hashmoneim, of Yosef's dreams, is to recognize that in both areas of our life, we could be aspirational, and we should be aspirational. And now I have a drasha for Shabbos. Good Shabbos.